Mr. Vice President, given present progress, will Vietnam still be a major issue in 1972?
I don't think that Vietnam itself will be a major issue, but I do think the whole question of American foreign policy, the issue of whether we should go back to an isolationist stature as a country or continue to exercise the function that we have as a world power will be a very critical issue of that campaign.
This is Profile, conversations with people in the news, a public affairs presentation of Metro Media Radio News.
Dan Blackburn in Washington. My fellow reporter on this edition of Profile is Carl Lubsdorf of the Associated Press. Our guest this week is a man who has made the phrase household word almost trite, the Vice President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew.
You said, Mr. Vice President, that Vietnam would not of itself be an issue in 1972, a major issue, but that foreign policy would. Does this mean that for all practical purposes, the war in Vietnam will have been over by 1972?
Well, I wouldn't want to
Our involvement in it, I should say.
I wouldn't want to make that as a prediction because, of course, it's dependent on many things, the chief among which is the attitude of the North Vietnamese toward our very serious initiatives for a conference table peace. Obviously, we'll still, in 1972, if we're forced to rely on Vietnamization as the only recourse to disengage from the war, we're still bound to have some logistical or supportive troops there. I'm confident that all of our combat people will be out of action by that time. But I think we will still realistically have some support troops in Vietnam unless the present intransigence of the North Vietnamese at the conference table is eased. In which case, I would hope that we'd be able to negotiate a settlement.
Would you envisage a sort of Korean-type settlement where we will, by the nature of things, be forced to maintain supportive troops for an indefinite period of time?
Well, let's remember that we don't have too many supportive troops in Korea at the present time. I think the level is something under 50,000 now. And I think we are contemplating reducing that further with the cooperation of the South Korean government because they have developed a great capability to take care of their own requirements. I think, yes, we are going to have an uneasy settlement of the type of Korea because I frankly am not optimistic enough to predict that a country that has waged an aggressive war of this type that the North Vietnamese have waged will really come to the table with clean hands and an effort to relieve permanently the tensions. I find that hard to believe.
Carl?
You said during your trip to Asia earlier this year that Laos and Cambodia were examples of countries where the United States might have gotten involved in bailing countries out of their internal problems. The question is, do you think the administration has actually increased the U.S. commitment to these countries by some of its actions this year, like the airstrikes in Laos and now the ground action in Cambodia?
I don't, because I think the president's been very careful to indicate that these supportive actions that have involved overflying or, in some cases, limited incursions of a temporary nature into other countries in Indochina and on the periphery would mean, in effect, that we are simply attempting to militarily support our Vietnamization policy. In short, they are all related to the war in Vietnam, and in no case is there any intention of expanding the conflict to these other countries. And we must remember, Carl, that the only reason we had to go into Cambodia was that the North Vietnamese, with 40,000 troops, violated that neutrality originally.
But doesn't the action in Cambodia have the side effect of helping to bolster the Lan Nol government there, especially if the South Vietnamese continue actions in Cambodia past the time when U.S. ground troops come out?
I think you could say honestly that it does have that side effect. It's not the principal reason for the involvement, but it is a side effect, and I might say one that we don't regard as an undesirable one. We feel that it's good that the Lan Nol government, the Cambodian government, is encouraged in its efforts to overcome the aggression from the North Vietnamese that it's been forced to suffer for years.
Do you feel that the Lan Nol government received any encouragement in becoming a government in the overthrow of Prince Sihanouk from the United States prior to the overthrow?
No, I'm positive that that did not happen. And the reason I'm so sure is that we didn't have any CIA people in the country, and we had a very, very small mission there, and that mission had only been there for a short time. That particular revolt came from the inside of the Cambodian government. Lan Nol was not an outsider. He was part of the Cambodian government under Sihanouk. And that surprised the United States as much as it did the rest of the world. We had nothing to do with it.
Mr. Vice President, the decision by the President to send American troops into Cambodia seemed to come to most observers who are not inside the government as very much of a sudden decision and very much of a surprise. Can you give us some feeling or some idea as to how this decision was reached and whether or not it was made on a very short basis?
Well, it certainly wasn't made on a short basis. This entire complex issue of the military conducting of the Vietnamese war is under constant scrutiny by the President and the NSC and the NSC staff, State Department and Department of Defense and other principals on a day-to-day basis. We had an NSC meeting not too long before this decision was made in which the issue was fully discussed. The President subsequent to that had additional meetings. He had a meeting I understand with Secretary Rogers and Secretary Laird. He meets many times a day with Dr. Kissinger. He had a meeting with me. We had discussions of these issues, and out of those discussions, the President made the decision. It was a military decision made as the Commander-in-Chief related to the proper and certainly the safeguarding of the proper conduct, the safeguarding of the American military exercise in Vietnam.
Was consideration of this move underway at the time the President made his speech announcing the withdrawal of 150,000 more troops from Vietnam?
Well, I'm not certain that any consideration of this was underway. This was under day-to-day scrutiny. We knew the Cambodian sanctuaries were there. We knew they were a debilitating thing for us because of the incursions that were taking place into South Vietnam involving some of our special forces troops that were right in the path of these people. We knew that they were sores, but we didn't realize how critical things were becoming until, as the President indicated, between April 20th and April 30th. The North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops in the sanctuaries began to move back out of them into Cambodia and actually to cut those roads and take those provincial capitals. And then the President, at that point, was faced with a critical decision that if we were going to do anything about those sanctuaries, that was the time to do them. He made that decision.
In assessing the impact in this country, the draft director, Curtis Tarr, said this week that the result of the Cambodian action has been to turn a majority of students against the administration's Vietnam policies. He went on to say that we haven't sold the logic of this policy to a lot of the public. Do you agree?
No, I don't. And I certainly don't agree that the demonstrations that took place in Washington and some of the demonstrations that have taken place on the campus are really indicative of a deep-seated student hostility to the Cambodian decision. I think that much of the Cambodian decision was misunderstood, and the facts of it are just coming out. And I've certainly received quite a few letters from students, and I've seen increasing comment from students indicating that they are not against the Cambodian decision They would be against the extension of the war into Cambodia, but for the limited military purpose announced, if the president hews to his timetable, I don't think that you'll find the preponderant number of students would be against it.
Why do you think it was misunderstood?
The typical reaction is to judge a headline without reading the details of it. And of course, the headlines were the United States goes into Cambodia, and the immediate assumption was that this is an extension of the war on a permanent basis into another country.
Do you feel that the case might have been presented better initially by the administration to avoid this misunderstanding, or even to avoid the headlines that you just mentioned?
Well, I think this, that the president had a choice. He could have probably done a better and more careful public relations job in the United States at the risk of affecting the outcome of the military operation. Surprise was inherent in this operation. It was a very successful part of the operation. And had the president prepared the public relations side of it in this country, he would have forsaken the advantage of surprise, and probably we would have lost a great number more troops than we have in that particular operation.
Mr. Vice President, a few months ago you said, "I, for one, will not lower my voice until the restoration of sanity and civil order allow a quiet voice to be heard once again. The mob, the mobilization, the moratorium have become somewhat fashionable forms of citizen expression, but they are negative in content, disruptive in effect." Have you been asked to lower your voice by the president?
Absolutely not. And those comments that you just referred to, I believe as strongly as I believed them the day I said them, and I will continue to speak out on these subjects.
Has anyone in the administration representing the president approached you and said to you, "Mr. Vice President, would you speak more softly? Would you delete certain phrases from prepared remarks?"
This Absolutely kind of not.
Secretary of HEW Finch said last week that your rhetoric, as I believe was his word, contributed to heating up the climate in which the Kent State students were killed. Do you feel that so?
Secretary Finch denied those remarks, as I recall.
I wonder if there has been some dispute over whether Secretary Finch said that. The reporter who was present claims he did, and the secretary says he didn't. I'm wondering whether you feel that you have been subjected to an unfair amount of criticism for your remarks, or that you have been blamed for creating a situation that you feel you did not create.
Well, I think in some quarters, there's been an effort, in a very contrived sense, to transfer some responsibility to what I had said. But I think the public is just fed up to the gills with this kind of attitude, and I don't think it had any success at all.
Do you think that there should be a cooling of rhetoric? The president said in his news conference that his motto was that when the action got hot, the rhetoric should become cool. Do you share this view?
It'd be nice if we could have it, and I think the best place and the first place it should begin is on the editorial pages of some of the Eastern newspapers.
How about in the speeches of public officials on either side?
Well, I think that it would be good if we could have a negotiated settlement of accelerated rhetoric, but I unilaterally do not intend to withdraw.
There's been a lot of talk about disunity in the country in the wake of the demonstrations that have followed the Cambodian invasion. When the administration began, President Nixon set a sort of a theme of forward together and a goal of unifying the country. Do you think the country's more unified now than it was when you came into office?
Let me put it this way. I don't think it's any more divided. I think it's impossible to construe the president's words to mean that every single citizen can be converted into a desirable contributing member of society. We could do away with all the jails and the asylums for the criminally insane if that were true. There always will be in a country of as many people as we have a certain segment of society who will persist in antisocial conduct. My purpose is not to rationalize, accept, or condone their illegal actions, but to separate them effectively from the society that can work together and go ahead in the interest of the United States.
Do you think you've been successful in separating them?
I think I've done a lot to rally public opinion among the people who want to see this country continue to oppose those who would just as soon see it fall.
Would it be fair, sir, to say that you feel that with your words you have attempted to draw a fence around that group that you just described?
You mean the criminally insane and those people? Yes, I think that's fair.
What would you offer as an assessment of the demonstration that took place here in Washington a week ago?
Well, I don't think it... I think a lot of those students were out on a typical spring lark. I think there were some who actually had the feeling they were participating in a very important venture. I certainly don't downgrade their efforts. I think the people who spoke and publicly appeared on the media at the demonstration are the same tired old radicals that everybody in the country is sick of listening to. And even the students themselves seemed more inclined to get in the fountain and frolic than to listen to those speeches.
Do you think that there are any things that some of these groups are saying that deserve a hearing? There's some points that the students are making,
yes,
you think that...
they've been heard, Carl, they've been heard over and over and over again. Now, they really aren't complaining about not being heard. What they're complaining about is that their judgments are not being accepted and immediately transferred into foreign policy of the United States. And the president has decided after hearing them that perhaps he has better information and a better course to pursue than the one of simply bugging out of Vietnam.
Many of the young people who took part in the demonstrations and some of whose names are familiar to you and who've been involved in this activity for some time, such as Sam Brown, David Hawke, Charlie Palmer, have begun organizing petition campaigns and other lobbying-type efforts to work on Congress to vote for either the Cooper Church Amendment or the other amendment by Senators Hughes and McGovern and Goodell to cut off funds for the war in Vietnam. Do you think that this approach by the students is preferable to the approach of demonstrations?
Yeah, let me say before I answer that question, I loved Sam Brown when he was a belt. I think it's more profitable to work within the system, obviously. That's what we've been saying. I think that if they continue to exert the political pressures, that's a very desirable thing, because that does have an effect on opinion and on the Congress and on the conduct of the affairs of the country. But when they do that, they must then propose specific alternatives, because the people of the United States are not naive enough to simply discard what they have for nothing. So if we can get them into this stance where they're expected to contribute something of value instead of screaming obscenities on the street, then we're going to be greatly enhanced in the value of what they can contribute.
Which I think brings us to the alternatives that they're supporting in their letters that they're mailing out now, which is the McGovern, Hatfield, Goodell, Cranston, Hughes proposal that would cut off funds over a given period of time.
Do I have time to talk about that a little bit?
I think you've got a minute or two.
That's not enough, really. Well, let me begin simply by saying that the amendments that would cut off military appropriations to sustain Vietnam are untenable for many reasons. The first reason is that the Congress is partly responsible for the presence of those troops in Vietnam. When the Tonkin Gulf resolution was voted, there's not a single member of the Senate that's there now that voted against it. They were all for it. So these people are in Vietnam with the support, assistance, and specific approbation of the Congress. Now, to turn around and say that the president as commander-in-chief is going to be cut off in his flexibility to conduct tactical operations for a body of men that are there because they're there with the consent of previous commanders-in-chief and the acquiescence of the Congress, is to jerk the rug out from under our fighting forces. This has happened before as far as the use of troops without a declaration of war. President McKinley sent troops, 5,000, into the Boxer Rebellion. President Taft sent troops to Nicaragua. President Truman sent many troops into Korea, and some of them went into North Korea. And as a matter of fact, President Wilson sent troops into Veracruz, Mexico, all without congressional declarations of war. So we see not what the Congress would indicate is a brand new step on the part of the president. We see a president inheriting a war. We see a president with a large body of troops there with the acquiescence of a Congress, and we see that Congress, because of the heat of public pressure, attempting for political gain mainly, in my judgment, to jerk the rug out from under the commander-in-chief and the troops by denying them the military assistance that they need to function effectively. And I say this is a reprehensible attitude on the part of the Congress and those that support those resolutions.
Is there any way that the administration could accept the Cooper Church Amendment, which would be limited strictly to Cambodia?
No way that I know of.
Do you feel that the current drive in Congress to reassert what they call their constitutional prerogative is a proper move? Do you think Congress has been frozen out?
I don't think it's a proper move. As I've indicated, we're not talking about a new commitment of United States troops into a new war. We're talking about a tactical judgment of a commander-in-chief related to a war that's being conducted with the acquiescence of the very people who are now criticizing it. And I think it's completely invalid as a judgment.
Mr. Vice President, this week in an article you wrote for TV Guide, you said, if one point of view is presented, a conscious effort is made to find its opposite and present a new controversy to the public in discussing television news. You said, this raises the question, how much overemphasized controversy and contrived action can be presented night after night to the American people before reality is clouded by imagery? My question to you is that I had for some time been under the impression that one of the jobs of newsmen was to go out and get both sides of the question.
Well, I think you've got a good point, and I don't think what was written there on reflection is written as well as it could have been. What I meant was this. I'm not talking about the considered debating of points, people to debate the validity of one side of the argument or the other. I'm talking about the tactic that's used too much in the media of going out and getting someone to express a very visceral, inflammatory opinion, and then rushing out and finding someone else whom the interviewer knows is going to be terribly repelled by that opinion and asking him what he thinks of what the other man said. I've seen this technique used to a great extent many years on television at political conventions where somebody will run from, let's say, Senator Goldwater to Senator Javits and say that one said something, what do you think about it? And of course, it's oversimplified and contrived, and the dispute is artificial. That's the kind of dispute I was referring to, not the quiet weighing of two opposite points of view.
Do you think that the media, by focusing on some of the more colorful language that you've used in your speeches, has been giving the public a fair impression of what you're trying to say?
Well, I think that it's been colorful language, which is a very kind term compared to what some editorialists have called it, has been focused on a little too heavily to the exclusion of some of the very serious matters that I weighed, I thought, in very impartial fashion. But I can't complain about it because, of course, I knew that that kind of language would attract the attention when I used it. And I confess that one of my reasons for using it was to attract attention so that someone could hear it.
Obviously, someone did. And that leads me to the question that a lot of other people have wondered about. With all the people listening to the language that you've been using and the attention you have been attracting, how do you feel about the talk of an Agnew presidency?
Well, I'm not a bit interested in an Agnew presidency, and as a matter of fact, I haven't even thought about a continued Agnew vice presidency yet. So it's a question of letting things develop as time goes on. I'm supporting my president. I can intend to do that. If he seeks re-election, which I think he will do, I will be as supportive as I can to him in any way he thinks is proper.
President Nixon said he made his Cambodian decision without regard to whether or not he would be a one-term president. Do you expect him to be a two-term president?
If he keeps making decisions as good and careful as the ones he's made, I don't think he'll be able to avoid being a two-term president.
Would you expect under normal circumstances to be a two-term vice president?
I don't know what normal circumstances would be, and again, I'd have to defer judgment on that to a lot further on in this term.
Our guest on this edition of Profile has been the Vice President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew. My fellow reporter has been Carl Lubsdorf of the Associated Press. This is Dan Blackburn in Washington.
You've been listening to Profile, a conversation with one of this week's newsmakers. Profile is a public affairs presentation of Metro Media Radio News.
WNEW, Metro Media Radio in New York.